Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Sometimes a lot of things happen at once, and one of those moments was September 1918. In this month, a division of Massachusetts militia volunteers led the first unified American fighting force into battle in France, turning the tide in World War I. At the same time, the world's deadliest pandemic, the Spanish flu, erupted in Boston and its suburbs, killing about 700,000, bringing death first to military facilities and then to the civilian population. And the U.S. government actively worked to tamp down on coverage of the pandemic, probably making it a lot more deadlier than it would have been otherwise. At the same time, a young pitcher named Babe Ruth led baseball's most dominant team, the Boston Red Sox, to a World Series victory, the last that the Red Sox would see for 86 years. In this episode, I'm talking with author Skip Desjardins, who's the author of the new book, September 1918, War, Plague, and the World Series. He mentions that all these events converging aren't just coincidence, but have to do with massive shifts that are happening in American society. It's sort of a tipping point moment, and all of these events are the visible effects of it. So in this discussion, we talk about a bunch of sensational true stories that simultaneously strike America. So this is an interesting look at a hinges in history moment that happens. Hope you enjoyed this discussion with Skip Desjardins. Skip, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Scott. Glad to be here.
What you've written about is interesting. I don't think I've had a guest that has keyed in on a particular date like you have. Not a day in history, but a month in history. And you notice that there's something particular about September 1918. Spanish flu happens. Millions die. This is the ramp up to the World War. This is the ramp up to the World Series. What got you into this month in particular where you noticed that there were so many things converging?
So I'm a New England guy. I've lived in New England my whole life. I'm a lifelong Red Sox fan. I was reading a novel by Dennis Lehane, and he's written a whole string of best-selling novels, many of which have been turned into successful movies like Gone Baby Gone, Mystic River, and others. And he wrote a book called The Given Day, which was set in Boston in 1919. And two characters captured my imagination from that book. One was Babe Ruth, who is literally an integral character in that novel. But it was not the fat, pigeon-toed Babe Ruth that we've all seen in old newsreels running in fast motion around the bases, looking comical. It was athletic, vibrant, in his prime, 24-year-old Babe Ruth, who we don't get much of a glimpse of in our sort of casual approach to baseball. But this was a guy who was at once the best pitcher in baseball and the best hitter in baseball. And I was really captured by that idea of a young athletic guy in the prime of his life. And the other was Calvin Coolidge, who in the novel is governor of Massachusetts, and dealing with the various events that were taking place in Boston that year. And that brought me up short a little bit. It's a little embarrassing at this point to admit that I didn't know that Calvin Coolidge was a Massachusetts politician. I'd thought of him as being from Vermont. He was born there, grew up there, went back to Vermont after he was president. But his entire political career, until he went to Washington as vice president, was in Massachusetts. And I had no idea that that was the case. And the novel references the previous year and the World Series and the Spanish flu epidemic, which got me to wonder, well, why was the World Series played in September? It's always played in October. And why in the world would people go out to Fenway Park and cram into those little tiny seats, shoulder to shoulder in a big crowd, at exactly the point in time when doing that could kill you? And I had a great-grandfather who died in the Spanish flu. So here were these events from kind of my world, Boston and the Red Sox and Spanish Spanish flu that seemed to have a connection that I got interested in learning more about. And as I started to look into it and do some research, all the other elements of what was going on in that particular month began to surface for me. And every so many hours I spent in the library, some new amazing connection would pop up between events in the United States and even the world that had a direct line to Boston and Massachusetts during that 130-day period.
Okay, so it sounds like we're looking at a narrative, and could you walk me through the order of operations? Because we have a lot of things here. We have probably the worst pandemic in American history. We have something auspicious happening to the World Series, which is probably the biggest cultural touchstone in America at this point. We have America ramping up its military machine like it never has before. So in early September, what kicks off all of these different events, do you see?
The thing that kicks off the month that will be a through line throughout the month is the first outbreak of Spanish flu. The reality, though, is that even though it's percolating and spreading in the early days of the month, people don't really understand that, and it doesn't burst upon the consciousness of the people in Massachusetts until later in the month. It takes some time to incubate, and it takes some time to spread. But the war and the flu are inextricably linked. The first cases in Boston pop up at the Charlestown Naval Yard in Boston Harbor and very quickly get transferred out to Camp Devens, which is a massive army facility just west of Boston, because there are people moving back and forth between those two facilities. And at the same time, there are civilians moving in and out of both of those bases, and inevitably it gets spread that way as well. But it takes a little time for an epidemic like this to ramp itself up and for the math to work itself out. The great irony or tragedy, depending on how you look at it, of this is that the military was fully aware that epidemic was a gigantic threat. In every war in human history, more people have died of disease than of wounds.
Right.
It's just a fact of war, and always has been. It's men packed into tight spaces, and it's easy for contagion to spread. So the government was actively working to prevent that. And the doctor on site at the Charlestown Navy Yard, when the very first cases showed themselves, was a guy named Milton Rosenau, who was the single preeminent expert in infectious disease in all of America. The single person best equipped to identify this disease, to isolate it, to treat it, and to keep it from spreading, saw patient number one. And yet, even though he did all the right things, as far as medical knowledge would allow at that point in time, 100 years ago, the math overwhelmed the science. It spread too quickly for him to contain it. And he tried. He isolated the first cases, then found anyone that they had come in contact with and isolated those people, and found anybody that they in turn had come in contact with and tried to isolate them. But he could never keep up, and his staff could never keep up with how many people had been exposed before anyone knew that this flu existed. And had it not been for the war, this kind of epidemic may not have spread as quickly as it did. It would not certainly have come from overseas. The version that we had here in the United States at that time was a mutation of the influenza that was passing around the troops on the front lines in Europe. And as the month went on, the flu epidemic was really exacerbated by military commanders and governmental officials all trying to operate under the umbrella of a massive war effort.
I mean, something that really surprises me is the media reaction to this, because nowadays, in response to coverage of the Zika virus, there's probably 10 times as many articles on the Zika virus, which how many people has that killed? Not even 100?
Yeah.
And this is also a period, I think, not too far away from yellow journalism. So from what I understand, there was pretty big press censorship on Spanish influenza. Was this a government response? Was this some sort of misguided sense of patriotism that we tamped down on coverage of this? What's going on here?
All of the above. So we tend to forget now that there were laws passed during this period of time, came to be known as the Alien and Sedition Acts. And a portion of those laws said that it was illegal to publish anything in newspapers or magazines that was critical of the president or critical of the government or could be considered unpatriotic or could be considered bad for morale. And editors of newspapers and magazines around the country went to jail for violating this law. And as you can tell from the description, it's a pretty broad category. And believe it or not, the people who were in charge of deciding what was unpatriotic and what should be prosecuted were postmasters, since most of this media was spread through the mail. And so newspaper editors were afraid, put it simply. They didn't want to be printing anything that could be considered bad for morale. And what could be worse for morale than to tell your readers that there are hundreds of people dropping dead in the streets in your city? So they were afraid to be very aggressive about talking about this in the newspapers. And there were 8 daily newspapers in Boston at this time. And what mention of flu there was in the first 2 to 3 weeks of September, even as people were dying, was buried on back pages for the most part, or was a verbatim recitation of what the government was telling them. And what the government was telling them every day was, nothing to see here. Everything's fine. It's just the flu. We've had flu seasons before. Don't worry about it. Every day, the Boston City Health Commissioner would come out and say, the worst is over. Today's going to be better than yesterday. And he would say it day after day after day, even as death rates skyrocketed. And it was well-intentioned, I suppose. They were trying to do 2 things. One, prevent panic. And 2, keep up morale. And morale was critical on the home front because, 1, unlike today, the war was funded by borrowing money from citizens. Citizens bought stamps that were then turned into books that were then turned into war bonds. And the United States needed the money that citizens were effectively loaning them in order to fund the war. So bad morale means bad fundraising. Also, telling people there's a horrible epidemic out there and you're more likely to catch it if you are in the company of other people might mean that people would stay home from their jobs in critical industries that were supporting the war. In New England, that was textile mills that were making uniforms and blankets for the troops overseas, shoe factories that were making boots, armament factories like the Springfield Rifle Company in Massachusetts that was literally making the guns and bullets that these troops needed, and shipbuilding factories. They needed people to go to work to keep up productivity. And so there were all these reasons not to tell the general public at any given time how bad this flu really was. And as a result, it just spread and spread because no one had any information. And in fact, over the course of September, in the city of Boston, there were 4 massive parades. There was a Labor Day parade. There was a giant parade to celebrate the opening of a new shipbuilding factory. There was a giant parade to drum up support for the Liberty Loan, which is what they called the fundraising efforts to fund the war. And each time, because each of those projects seems really critical to the war effort at the time, the government, and in concert with them, the media, urged people to get out into the streets. And when they did, They breathed on each other, they coughed on each other, and they just created this giant atmospheric soup of germs, which spread the disease even further. So flu and the war can't really be separated.
Right, and it's interesting from how we understand these events today that most people know, or a few people know, that this is the centennial of the First World War, or the end of it at least. But with Spanish flu, that's almost more of a trivia point with people, even though far more people died of this. The impact could arguably be far higher, at least in that year.
Yeah, this was the worst pandemic in the history of the world. More people died of the Spanish flu than the Black Plague. Conservative estimates, because 100 years ago record keeping wasn't as precise as it is today, and certainly that was the case in foreign countries around the world. But conservative estimates today are that 100 million people died of the Spanish flu. In the United States, it was nearly 700,000. Can you imagine today if we the panic there would be if we had an epidemic raging that killed 700,000 people? So their concerns about that weren't far off. It's just they had unintended consequences. At its peak in Boston, one person was dying from the Spanish flu every 9 minutes. Last year, which was a fairly significant flu season in Massachusetts and around the country, 5,000 people got sick with the flu in the state of Massachusetts. In 1918, 5,000 people died of the Spanish flu in Massachusetts. And at one point in the third week of September, 85,000 people just in the city of Boston were sick. It's just unimaginable today to think that a disease this deadly would be this widespread.
Well, okay, so these two factors here, the First World War going on and the Spanish flu outbreak, are intertwined. And like you said, you can easily chart when this will happen when you pack a lot of people together, when you don't have strict hygiene protocol. It's just going to happen. Now let's talk about the World Series. It's played in September. How was that choice made to hold it in September instead of October? And how do these other big events relate to that decision?
Yeah, so there was my initial question. That's the impetus, I suppose, for my exploration that led to this book. And the answer is also tied to the war. When Woodrow Wilson was reelected in 1916, it was on a slogan of "He kept us out of war." He was inaugurated on March 4th, and by the middle of April, just 6 weeks later, he asked Congress to declare war. So he had a tough job on his hands, which was to take the country that he had whipped up into an anti-war position to ensure his reelection and turn it on a dime and get all of America behind the war effort that he had been campaigning against just a little while before. And the reason he needed to do that is because we were completely unprepared. We had no standing army to speak of. We had some state militias and a moderate force that could be cobbled together if necessary. We had no war industry. We were still building wooden sailing ships. So all of that had to be geared up and geared up fast. And a draft had to be instituted to actually build an army. So by May of 1918, a year after war had been declared, the government issued what became known as the Work or Fight Order. And that said that every man in America between the ages of 18 and 30 had three choices. Sign up, enlist in the military. Make yourself eligible for the draft. Get on the draft board to register and take your chances. Or three, get a job in a war-related industry, something that had a direct line to helping the war effort. Not just any job, but an actual war-related job. Well, baseball players were certainly between the ages of 18 and 30, And there was initially a little bit of question if they were going to be exempt from this law as being an entertainment service that was good for morale and therefore could tangentially be considered part of the war effort. But the government wasn't buying. Excuse me. They decided that baseball players were eligible just like everybody else, but they did reach a compromise with baseball to say, look, you can play until Labor Day instead of the July 1st deadline. And then all but the two teams who were playing in the World Series, all those players have got to meet the requirements. You get 2 weeks to finish up the World Series, and then even those teams, all the players have to meet these requirements. And baseball will shut down until the war is over. And that's why the World Series got moved up to September. But the war, again, sort of had this overarching effect on everything in American society. And because what we would now consider to be baseball's target audience was meeting one of these three criteria, they were either working or fighting. Once the World Series was played and the first three games were held in Chicago, there was nobody to buy tickets. These were all day games. People were, you know, bound to these factory jobs and or serving in a military base somewhere. And there wasn't a ton of expendable income. Folks were, when they had some money left over, were tending to buy war bonds, as they were being reminded to do every single day. So ticket sales were incredibly disappointing. And it led to bigger problems once the World Series moved on to Boston later in the month.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Yeah, and I can imagine a lot of fans aren't pleased with this, that these players are exempted and they're not. And I'm kind of surprised to hear this because in World War II, baseball players, a lot of movie stars are famously serving in the war effort. Do you think that it's sort of like a reaction to this? Is there a lesson learned from World War I that you really should visibly join the effort? Or do you think there's any connection?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. What baseball learned in World War I was that public sentiment was absolutely not on their side. Here were guys who were getting paid to play a kid's game at exactly the same time as their peers were dying in these muddy fields in France. And you can imagine if you had a son or a brother or a father fighting in the war in a trench somewhere over in Europe, that you weren't looking all that kindly on these guys who were getting paid during the regular season, maybe five times what the average factory worker was making. And then again, another one or two times the annual salary of a factory worker just to play in the World Series. So they had no great public support. Now, there were a number of baseball players, including some very famous and talented baseball players, who didn't stick around. They enlisted and were fighting overseas. The Cubs, for instance, played this World Series without their best pitcher, Grover Cleveland Alexander, who early in the summer had enlisted, and when the World Series was being played, was in France serving in an artillery battalion. And there were others who had left the teams to take a job, an actual job somewhere in a factory turning out chips or boots or blankets. There were other baseball players who took jobs in factories where their main responsibility was to play for the factory team. And there was a very robust industrial league of baseball teams around the country, and it was a point of pride for your local armaments factory or your local shipbuilding yard that your baseball team could beat some other factory's baseball team. So there were alternatives for these guys. But again, not the most popular alternatives if it was found out that their main job was to play baseball, even though they were officially on the ranks of a factory.
Well, I left you hanging a little bit. You were going to talk about how the World Series was affected directly by this, and there were low ticket sales. So what happens with the World Series itself?
So the first three games are played at Comiskey Park in Chicago, not at what later became known as Wrigley Field, because Comiskey Park had more seats, and baseball was convinced that they were going to need all those seats because they were going to sell out every game. Instead, it was clear that there was very little demand for tickets. Almost half the seats were going unsold for the first game, which was luckily, I suppose, for baseball, rained out. And in a panic, the owners and the commissioners of baseball dropped ticket prices all the way down to regular season levels. Then, as now, if you buy a World Series ticket, it's more expensive than a regular season ticket. But demand wasn't there, and so they dropped the prices. Baseball players in the World Series, even today, get paid based on ticket revenue from the first four games of the series. There's guaranteed to be four games, but they don't want players artificially dragging it out to seven to try to get paid more. So they get paid on four games regardless. And they had received some paperwork from the National Commission that sort of outlined what their pay was going to be, and they saw some figures on the paper but didn't pay a ton of attention. Until the first three games in Chicago were complete, and the teams boarded a train to go back to Boston. They had foregone the typical World Series schedule of play some games in one city, go to the other city for the middle games, go back to the original city for some more. They're trying to conserve on fuel and resources. And as such, they even boarded just a single train, which was unheard of at the time. So here were both teams, reporters, baseball officials, all on a single train from Chicago to Boston. And that's when money trouble started. The players had time to sort of look the paperwork over a little bit and realize that what they had thought was the minimum amount they were going to get, $2,000 for the winners, $1,000 for the losers, was in fact a cap on what they could make. And ticket sales of the first three games were such that they weren't going to come anywhere near even those numbers. It looked like the winners may make less than $1,000, $800 or $900 maybe. And now they were mad. And they wanted to talk to the commissioners that ran the game, and they kept getting put off. We can't talk to you today. One of our guys isn't here. We'll talk to you when we get to Boston on the train. Come by and see us in the morning after the train pulls in. And each time they tried to meet with the commissioners wouldn't show up. Finally, they got word indirectly from the commissioners that said, look, let us play the fourth game. This first game in Boston, we'll see how ticket sales are. Then we'll have all four games in the book. We'll know exactly how much money there is to be split. And then we can have a discussion as to how to split it. So players reluctantly went along. They played the fourth game. And then after the fourth game, they went to the commission again and say, okay, time to figure this out. And again, the commission wouldn't meet with them. So the day of the fifth game, the two teams showed up at Fenway Park and refused to play. Wouldn't put on their uniforms, trying to put up a united front, and said, look, unless we get some satisfaction here about how much money we're going to make, we're just not going to play. And they waited and they waited and they waited, and the three members of the National Commission that ran baseball finally showed up at Fenway Park about 10 minutes before the game was scheduled. And two out of the three were so drunk they could barely stand up. So a hastily arranged meeting was put together underneath the stands at Fenway Park in the umpire's dressing room. And the three commissioners were there, and a representative of each of the Red Sox and the Cubs were there, and a bunch of other players, and the press, and some fans, all crammed into this hot little room. And Harry Hooper, the outfielder for the Red Sox, tried to make the case for both teams that said, look, we deserve more. You've changed the rules a little bit. You misled us. We really deserve more than this. And he was getting nowhere. And finally, he turned to the press and said, it looks like we're not going to accomplish anything. There's nobody here for us to talk to because there's nobody here who can talk. So he went back to the locker room and addressed both teams and said something I found really interesting that's been, I think, underreported in the history of this World Series. He said to both teams, if the Red Sox win today, the World Series is over. And we will have lost any opportunity to negotiate a better deal with the owners. And lo and behold, the Red Sox went out and lost in a game in which they played a very half-hearted effort, but lived to fight another day on the money front. It's been rumored over the last few years that there was some question as to whether maybe the Cubs had purposely thrown the 1918 World Series to gamblers a year ahead of the famous Black Sox scandal of 1919. And there's some circumstantial evidence that you could take either way about that. But one thing that seems very clear to me after doing this research is that it's pretty obvious that the Red Sox put no effort into winning Game 5 and maybe not purposely lost, but weren't upset that they lost so that they continued to fight about money with the owners. It didn't help. The owners wouldn't budge. And so they reluctantly decided they'd go ahead and play Game 6. They weren't getting anywhere. Public opinion was against them. They had no leverage. They just weren't going to get their money. And so they trudged into the ballpark for Game 6. The Red Sox actually took their championship photo before the game was even played. Both teams kind of went through the motions in what was an uneventful, undramatic, boring baseball game that the Red Sox won. And when it was over, they simply walked off the field. And the fans left the stands. No celebration, no joyous occasion. Now, part of that was that this was the fourth World Series the Red Sox had won in 6 years. They were the most dominant team of the age. So this was a little bit commonplace for them to win another World Series. But mostly it was just they were anxious to just get it over with, figure out what they were going to do about their draft status or their job in a factory somewhere. And baseball was going to shut down until the war was over, and they kind of were okay with that. They were kind of fed up. Little did anybody know that it would be 86 years before the Red Sox would win another World Series and 95 years before they'd win one at Fenway Park.
And I wonder, what was the public reception to this? Because I remember in the 90s when there was a huge backlash against baseball for the season ending over the player dispute on salary. And you have something a little bit similar here. Players that are not fully getting into the game over dispute on salary at a time when they're already stretching their likability and trust with the public by playing instead of serving in the middle of the war effort. Did you see a sense of a public reaction to this?
Yeah, and it wasn't good for players. You know, part of it was the idea that here these healthy young men are not having to put their lives at risk. And why does my son or my nephew or my brother have to get drafted and go serve overseas and maybe die? And these guys don't. So that was a very vehement part of the reaction. The other was the inability of the average person in America to identify with the kind of money these guys were making. Like, they were upset that they weren't going to make $2,000, that they were only going to make $1,000. There was another strike going on in Boston at exactly the same time. The motormen on the subway system were on strike, trying to get a raise to 35 cents an hour. So to them, this $1,000 that the winners were going to get, even though it was less than their expectations, was a fortune. It was a year's pay. And so they had no sympathy whatsoever for players or owners, by the way, because owners were clearly just rich guys that owned teams for their own amusement, not unlike today. And so all of society was pretty disgusted with baseball at the time and ready for it to sort of go away for the duration of the war. Nobody knew the duration of the war was 8 more weeks, but baseball was in a very precarious position at that point in time. Fortunately for the sport, two things kind of happened. One was that America, after the armistice, took on this amazing attitude of optimism. Everything looked great again. Everything was happy and upbeat. And this is what kind of led to the Roaring Twenties, this renewed economic climate, a sense of optimism, of happiness that the war was over and America had come to the rescue and sort of saved the world for democracy. And the other thing that happened was Babe Ruth. Ironically, though, not for the Red Sox. After the 1919 season, he was famously sold to the Yankees and just captured the American attention. And in following his exploits every day as this outsized personality with immense talent, kind of ushered in this golden age of sports in the 20s. And so all was kind of forgotten and forgiven. And you're right, this kind of thing has happened to baseball over the years, and it always seemed that a particular personality came along and lifted the game onto his shoulders and brought it back to prominence. And the great example is 20 years ago or so, after baseball had gone through a work stoppage and actually canceled the World Series, just on the heels of that, Cal Ripken made his run at the all-time record for most consecutive games played, and captured America's attention and made everybody feel good about baseball again. And the ill feelings of the baseball strike were put behind them. And Ruth did that post-World War I for baseball and for the country.
And speaking about Babe Ruth in particular, you had mentioned that when you were thinking about this book, you saw pictures of him. He's not this overweight man that you see. He's not the Babe Ruth that starred in that embarrassing movie where he cures it. Kids' cancer from hitting a home run. What's that movie called?
Yep.
It's a. I'll have to look that up, but that's just a bad movie cliche for the ages. But this is a young, vibrant Babe Ruth. And was there anything that stuck out to you about him in this World Series?
Yes, and it was a theme that began earlier in the season. Yeah, you know, he had been this fantastic pitcher. During this World Series, he breaks the record for most consecutive scoreless innings pitched by a pitcher. He had started it back in the 1916 World Series. It continued into 1918, and it was a record that stood for more than 40 years afterwards. And in fact, in his autobiography after his career, he said that he was prouder of his scoreless innings record than he was of any of his hitting records. So he was a fantastic pitcher. But he was clamoring to hit. He was a great hitter, even on every fourth day, which is when he was playing. And because the Red Sox roster was depleted and having lost so many people to the war effort, they needed more and better players. And Harry Hooper, again, the Red Sox outfielder, badgered the manager and said, "Hey, why don't you let Ruth hit more often? Why don't you find a place to play him in the field?" For two reasons. One, he's a great hitter. And two, do you really want Babe Ruth hanging around with nothing to do three out of every 4 days? He's going to get in trouble. So let him play. And the manager thought, well, I'll be a laughingstock. Pitchers don't play every day. If I change that, people are going to laugh at me. He finally gave in early May. He put Ruth in the game at first base, the first time he'd ever played anywhere but pitcher. And, of course, he hits a home run in that game and goes on a hitting tear over the next few weeks. By the end of June, at the time, the American League home run record for a season was 16. By the end of June, Ruth had 10 and was about to just obliterate this home run record. But again, the worker fight order, which was coming into effect on July 1st, meant that even more Red Sox players left and the team was even more shorthanded. And they clearly needed him more as a pitcher than they did as a hitter. So he got fewer and fewer days to play in the field. Excuse me. By the time the World Series rolled around, those old tensions resurfaced. Here they played 6 games against the Cubs. The Cubs used only 2 starting pitchers in those 6 games and just alternated days. And they were both left-handed pitchers. And so the manager of the Red Sox did not play Babe Ruth except on the days that he pitched. He wouldn't put him in the field. He wouldn't let him bat. And in fact, in a game in Chicago, with the Red Sox trailing 3-1 in the ninth inning on a day that Ruth did not pitch, this is game two, they're trailing in the ninth inning, they've got two men on and one out, and you've got Ruth sitting on the bench, and the manager passed him over to pinch hit, not once, but twice. He just decided that on the big stage here where everybody can see, I'm not going to be the joker who lets my pitcher also be a hitter. It worked out okay for the Red Sox, but it could have cost them dearly.
This is another convergence point where you have baseball, the Great War is happening in the background, and we mentioned Spanish influenza. I'd like to take a look at something where two of these things converge together, and that's the 26 Yankee division and their involvement in World War II. Could you describe that, unless there's anything else with the World Series you'd like to touch on before we shift focus?
No, I'm happy to shift focus. As we said, the United States didn't really have a standing federal army at the time that they declared war, but they did have these state militias. We'd call them National Guard units today. And the Massachusetts one was particularly well-trained and experienced and was one of the first American units in its entirety sent overseas in the very early part of 1918. And they served under French and British generals and saw a good deal of action. But by September of 1918, the American forces were gathered up into a single army under General Black Jack Pershing. There were enough troops in the field at that point that Pershing insisted that they be sort of reeled back in from their various deployments under other generals and said to the Allied commanders, we'll fight anywhere you want us to fight, but we will only fight as an American army in one place at one time. That didn't sit particularly well with the Allied commanders. And so in the middle of September, they sort of said to Pershing, oh, okay, here's your first assignment. I'm sorry. There's a particular piece of land in France that we have been fighting back and forth with the Germans about for 4 years. It's near a town named Saint-Mihiel, and it's what was called a salient. It's sort of a bubble, a little triangle that sticks out of the front lines. And we've captured it and lost it and captured it and lost it and have not been able to take it permanently. This is incredibly tough terrain where the Germans have really dug in with trenches and barbed wire barriers and things. And you want to fight as an American army? Fine. Go take that piece of land. Well, Pershing put together a war plan that was highly contingent on the 26th Infantry, known as the Yankee Division, because they were all from Massachusetts. And they took that piece of land in 12 hours that the French had been trying to take and hold for 4 years. It was a dramatic victory on September 12th, the day after the Red Sox won the World Series. And it was a key turning point in the war because certainly German troops and definitely the German high command realized after that big win by these Massachusetts men that there's a brand new army on the field. They're fresh. They're well-equipped. There's over a million of them. And we don't think we stand a chance anymore. And it crushed the morale of the Germans. So much so that within 2 weeks, they were beginning to open talks about an armistice and a peace deal. And the real winning battles of World War I, the final climactic battles of the war, took place into October and early November at the Meuse-Argonne, but it was the Battle of Saint-Mihiel and the actions of this 26th Infantry Division that really turned the tide. One more of these remarkable connections between Boston and Massachusetts and events that were playing out on the world stage in this 30-day period.
Another figure, too, is David Putnam. He's one of the early aviation heroes in American history. So what did he do to get this reputation?
Well, we all grew up reading Peanuts cartoons and knowing that Snoopy was the World War I flying ace battling against the Red Baron. But an ace was a real thing. It was a title given to American airmen when they had shot down five enemy aircraft. And David Putnam, who was from Newton, Massachusetts, and gone to Newton High School and then had gone to Harvard, was America's ace of aces. He was the leader. He had shot down more enemy aircraft than anybody else in the war. And because of that, he was pretty famous back here in the United States. His exploits were chronicled in newspapers across the country, and there were articles about battles that he'd won and dramatic dogfights that had taken place that he'd come out victorious. And so he was kind of a star. He had gone over to Europe, gone to his mother at one point, shortly after the United States declared war, but before we'd actually deployed, and said, look, I got to do my part. Like so many young men through the centuries, you know, there's a war going on and I'm itching to get involved. He took a cattle boat over to Europe because we were shipping live cattle over there to feed troops. I took a cattle boat, got himself a job in an ambulance corps, and then joined the Lafayette Escadrille, which was a unit of French planes with American pilots. And it was a way for Americans to sort of play a part in this war that was going on that America was not yet involved in. And because he was a great athlete, I think his hand-eye coordination lent itself well to being a pilot, and his aggressive nature as well. And he became just this fantastic pilot with seemingly no fear. On September 12th, the day that Yankee Division was winning the Battle of St. Mihiel, he was in the air over the battle. World War I was the first war in which it became a three-dimensional war rather than a two-dimensional war. Up to that point in history, war was about you advancing and the other guys retreating or you pushing them back and moving back and forth in two dimensions like a basketball game along a battlefield. World War I brings aircraft, and now suddenly it's a three-dimensional war. And you could be up above, and you could be doing reconnaissance, and you know where the enemy is located, and you can drop bombs on them. You can shoot them from these airplanes. And so it totally changed warfare, which is part of what was capturing the imagination of the people back home in hearing about stories about David Putnam. But on that September 12th, his luck ran out. He took on six German planes at once and was shot twice through the heart and was dead before his plane even touched down on the ground. And he was 19 years old, which stunned me when I did the math and figured that out, but shouldn't have. You know, it is still true, I suppose it has always been true, that we send our young men off to fight wars. But I had read so much about David Putnam, and he had been so celebrated here in America that when the light bulb did finally go on in my head and I realized he was just a teenager, it seemed so incongruous from all that he had accomplished.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Well, to tie in a lot of these different themes together, I'm wondering, with this convergence of all these things happening, World War I, America ramping up and getting involved in the war effort, and making that push that really gets over the tipping point where there's Allied victory on the horizon, with the effects on the World Series and leading into the golden age of sports, as you talked about, with one of the worst pandemics in history in total numbers, but just in terms of the percentage of the population, what would you say are the legacies of that convergence of all these different things happening together? And you see that what you argue that it's not just coincidence, but they're intertwined with each other. What are legacies that you see of this?
It's amazing what inflection points were taking place at that period of time. The ones we've talked about in terms of war and medical advances and sports, but in society in general. 1920 was the first U.S. census in which more people lived in and around cities than rural areas in America. So 1918 is right at that turning point. And part of that is driven by this war effort in which there are suddenly thousands of jobs available in factories in and around cities. And so people have an economic incentive to leave the farm and go get a job in one of these cities. It's also a driver of a sharp increase in immigration. Partly there are refugees from the war in Europe heading to America for greener pastures. Partly it is that we need a labor force. We've taken the critical mass of our labor force, men, and shipped them off to war, and somebody needs to replace them. And so immigration fills that gap. And it's evident, like so many other things in that month, in Massachusetts, where the elections that are held in the fall of 1918 result for the very first time in a Irish Democrat being elected to statewide office. There had been a generation after generation history of rock solid Republican Yankee control of state government in Massachusetts. Calvin Coolidge came out of that tradition. And here was the first indication that Irish Catholic politicians in Boston were on the rise and were going to play a more and more critical role. And today we would say this is when Massachusetts turned blue and went from a red state to a blue state and stayed that way for the past 100 years. The other way that that vacuum for labor was filled was with women who found themselves in the workforce, not doing what had traditionally been quote-unquote female jobs, teachers, nurses, things of that nature, housekeepers, but were on the factory floor. They were building ships and weaving blankets and making shoes. As a result, were very caught up in the labor movement as well. And that sense of activism gave a renewed life to the women's suffrage movement. And one of those remarkable coincidences of timing and geography that I cover in the book is that Maud Woodpark, a woman from Boston who was the leading suffrage advocate in Boston, was convinced to go to Washington and lobby on behalf of an amendment to the Constitution that would give women the right to vote. And almost single-handedly, she drives the women's suffrage amendment to a critical vote in the U.S. Senate, where her number one opponent is Henry Cabot Lodge, her own home state senator from Massachusetts. Sorry. Lodge and his fellow Republican senator, John Weeks, are leading the anti-suffrage movement in the Senate. And suffrage, in what seems strange today, was not a partisan issue. There were lots of Democrats and lots of Republicans in favor of women voting. There were lots of Democrats and lots of Republicans against women voting. It was very idiosyncratic based on the personalities of the politicians themselves. So we have this rise of industrial life in America, a migration to cities, the increase of importance of labor unions and labor rights, and this debut of women both as a labor force and a political force. And all of them have their roots in the fall of 1918 and in very specific ways in Massachusetts in September of 1918. And those issues still ring through our lives today.
Right. Well, a lot of events that simultaneously strike America at the same time. The book is September 1918, War, Plague, and the World Series. So Skip, thanks for sharing all these things with us. If people want to find you online, is there a website or Twitter or a best place to find you?
Yep. The book can be purchased at any of the online book sites or at your local bookstore, or you can get more information about the book at September1918.com or follow me on Twitter at Skip Desjardins.
Will do. Put that in the show notes so people can follow up. Skip, thank you for joining us.
I really appreciate it. I had a great time. Thanks.
All right. Well, that was the episode for today. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. First of all, I'd like to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and especially our spy masters, Baron Freyza, Carl from Norway, Chris from Maine, and Melissa Sarnowski. And I'll explain what that means in a second. If you want to support the show and help me keep producing this content, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, subscribe to the show and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to do that, you can go to historyunplugpodcast.com and there you'll find instructions. Two, join our Facebook group, which you can find if you just search for History Unplugged. And please like and share posts that I put up about new episodes. Three, submit a question to me so that I can answer it on air. You can email me at info@historyonthenet.com or leave a voicemail. And again, go to historyunplugpodcast.com and you'll find instructions. Lastly, and I think this one is the best, is to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army in the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the History Unplugged membership program. Learn how to join by going to patreon.com/unplugged. So here's what you get if you become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you join at the level of Scout, you can get early access to new podcast episodes, along with enjoying absolutely every single episode of the History Unplugged podcast ad-free, all 270 and counting episodes. If you join at the level of Intelligence Officer, you can also get access to premium episodes, like a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, or the 10-part series Ottoman Lives, a series that looks at the cast of characters that made up the Ottoman Empire, such as the Sultan, the Eunuch, the Harem Servant Girl, and the Soldier. And finally, if you join at the level of Spymaster, you get all the same stuff as the Scouts and Intelligence Officers, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode, a 3-pack of hardcover history books, plus you will be put at the very front of the line for me to answer your question about history, and I can guarantee I will dedicate an episode that's about an hour long or so to your question. Sign up at patreon.com/unplugged. Again, that's patreon.com/unplugged. Anyway, those are the ways you can help out the show. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.